Well, first of all, I want to thank the... Oh, no. I'm not going to tell you that story. It's a very long story. There's a vent here, and I know by a bitter experience if you put the view gaps here, they'd blow. So, okay. But that's another story. That was... I'm a theorist, so it's okay. Okay, so I put overview... First of all, I want to thank the organizers for organizing the conference, and I think that it's a really interesting idea to try to bring these fields together, and I'm mostly been of the areas, I know a couple things, but in the granular materials, it's an interesting thing to try to make an overview because I don't really know what the questions are. And so if you don't really know the question, it's sort of hard to say whether it's the same question as the question in another field. So that's why overview is in quotes, because in the end, I sort of just picked some things. And just so you know, the logic was partly things that I knew about. That's towards the end of the talk. So as it goes along, it gets closer and closer to work that I've done myself, and so I know about the subject. But then also, I looked at the speaker list and decided to say, well, what does bring these things together? So it's a very idiosyncratic view, and that's why overview is in quotes, because there are all sorts of things I left out, and there is a certain amount of, some things the library had sent to the binder, and so I didn't get it, and so I left it out, So just so you know, and I'm hoping to end early. And if to do that, I put my own work last, and if need be, I will skip it all, because I think I want to generate some discussion, okay? And I think that's more important than you hearing the details of my model. Okay, so that's the introduction to why overview is in quotes. And so first I'm going to say just, the obligatory slide introducing you to granular materials, and then the organization of the talk is... save them in case things get really bad. The organization is based on this review article that was written by Jaeger, Nagel, and Barringer, where they sort of were thinking about phases of sand, solid, liquid, and gas. And because I know, again, I've worked on the solid, I'd put it last so I could get more secure as the talk went along. So I've just reversed the order of what's in the review article. And I want to refer you to the review article because, again, I've made a very odd selection of topics, just things that I found interesting that I thought I would share. Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about is the sand as a gas. And here, I was motivated partly because George Cody, who I've never met, is giving a talk on... Are you him? Well, hello, and I will probably... are you he? I will probably mangle your work, but there were things that... All right. But there are things that made me think of stuff that has been going on in Leo Kadnoff's group in Chicago, and so I wanted to just mention it. So the soundbite here is that Sid mentioned it in his overview, that when you have these inelastic collisions, you form these structures, okay? And one of the things that Sid showed in this picture was these structures. You could see them, and they're these stringy things, right? But you can think about the velocity. And in the velocity, also, you find that, things are not random in the way that they would be if the collisions were elastic. And so you find that there is a cooperation between the fluctuations and the mean flow. And I believe that even though the Zhu and Kadnoff stuff I'm going to show you is extremely simplified, there's some interesting analogies to what George Cody has done in his experiments on fluidized beds. Okay, but again, the systems are not the same, but I found an interesting analogy, so I wanted to tell you about it. That'll be quick. Well, the whole talk will be quick. It will end at 9:35, I swear. The second thing is, this is actually the smallest part of the talk, because I just wanted to mention a couple things about sand as a liquid. And the first one is just sort of showing you some pictures, but really this question of if you want to make a hydrodynamic theory. There's, first of all, the question of this mean flow coupling to the fluctuations, which I'm going to talk about here. But then there's also a question of the boundary conditions. And I'll just show you that we have no idea what the boundary conditions should be. But they're definitely more complicated than in a typical fluid. Okay. Then the other thing I just wanted to say one or two things about is this question of the analogy to the glass transition in these compaction experiments. This is the one slide that was totally redundant. Sid has shown it. Sam Edwards has shown it, but I just wanted to say a couple words about that. Oh, And then finally, the sand is a solid, and this question of how the forces propagate. And there are some interesting issues here which I'm going to put as questions, because I do not know how important the role of the fact that the forces are non-cohesive. And again, that is something that distinguishes sand from some other systems, and so I just want to mention my questions about that. And then to summarize, I'll just summarize some of the questions. Okay, so here's the introduction. And my definition of a granular material is that it's a bunch of classical particles, big enough to be described by classical mechanics, interacting only by contact forces. And now I'm going to specialize for this talk to the case where, first of all, the particles have negligible deformation. And this distinguishes it from foams, where when you squish on them, there's deformation, also colloids. And then also, there are no cohesive forces. And I think, for me, one of the really interesting questions is how important that is. And I'll show you that in a bit. And that distinguishes it from wet sand or from a host of other systems. Okay, so, but again, I'm doing these cases in blue. And the reason we study them is first of all, because of their practical importance. There's some slide with some large number of dollars, but I forgot that one. But if you think of the pharmaceutical construction, and the chemical industry, which the fluidized beds are relevant to, I mean, you can come up with a very large number very easily. And it turns out, again, our understanding is poor, and so it's worth knowing about them. And then for purposes of this conference, and in particular to relate it to these other systems, I think I want to focus on the fundamental question. And at the broadest possible level, the reason why granular materials are interesting is because they're yet another example of a complex system with many degrees of freedom, incredibly far from equilibrium, and it's amenable to controlled experiments. And so therefore, we can hope to get concepts and understanding that are applicable to a large class of systems. Okay. And again, this way I've organized the talk is this question of the different phases, that depending on the environment that you put it in, sand can act like a gas, or like a liquid, or like a solid. So I just wanted to say one or two words about this question of being far from equilibrium. And because KT is so small in these systems, our intuition from StatMech of how to find out the probability of a configuration just won't work. So the point is that in StatMech we have this concept of the energy. And you say, well, if the energy is lower, then you're more likely to see the configuration. And so I have this stack of U-graphs here. And they interact via contact forces. And there's also gravity. And it is without a doubt true that the lowest energy configuration of the stack of U-graphs that is sort of attainable easily is on the floor. Okay? And unless I knock them over, you can sort of wait for them to spontaneously fluctuate to make it on the floor. And that will entertain you if I don't. But actually waiting for me to knock them over is much more likely to work. And so the question is, all right, well, what determines, you know, what the configuration is? And obviously it has something to do with history, the fact that I put them there. But then you would say, well, okay, as a function of history, what are the configurations that you're likely to see? And are there any fundamental principles that are generalizable to a large class of systems? Okay, and Sir Sam Edwards said yesterday in a very poetic way, which I could never reproduce, that we don't know. And he said, well, let's just take the simplest thing and assume that they're all equally likely. I mean, and that's certainly as good as my guess, but we don't know. Okay, and so we want to pose that question and answer it, but we don't know how so far.
I have a question. Assuming they're all equally likely means this will phase separate an interesting regime into a solid and a gas.
Right. I happen to believe that Sam Edwards, Sir Sam, with all due respect, is wrong on that. But I just said that it's as plausible as the next thing. I have nothing to replace his hypothesis with, and so I said, well, it's an open question. Okay. Now, you may say that we know enough to know that he's wrong, but let's defer that. Okay. But it's really, I mean, I think that this is the fundamental question. Am I insulting you? Okay.
But the point is that you shouldn't ask the question whether a particular piece of sand does something. But is it possible to construct a sound which does something? And what I'm saying is it's impossible to construct a sound which does this. And it's like
Okay. It's a different question. Okay. In which I'm glad that you clarified it. In which case, then I'm going to say, well, then what if you just do these other things that don't do the simple thing? And what things are those? So again, there's a whole host of things you can ask in this where do you go question, line of thought. I find that a fascinating line of thought. So then the other thing is that even if you don't know where you go, can you still say something? Can you say something that's true for almost all configurations, even if you don't know what the configuration is? And in the work that I've done that I'm sure I won't have time to tell you about, that's been our approach. We say, well, we don't know what the state is, but like, let's just sort of assume that we can look at all possible things that could possibly be, and can we still say something? Okay, this is a much weaker way of looking at things, because you really want to know where you go, as opposed to, well, you can end up in any of n places, and it's all the same. Okay, but this is very well tried. I mean, it's sort of a standard physicist thing, because then we say universality, and it sounds respectable. Okay. So that's sort of my overview of the overview. And now I just want to get to, again, this is sort of a random sampling of things that I found interesting in the stuff that I was going over. So first I want to talk about gas, sand as a gas. And the point of sand as a gas is it's when you're really agitating it. And one way of agitating it is by moving the walls and, you know, hitting the particles, and then they collide, and there's substantial kinetic energy. And another way of agitating it, which George Cody will talk about, is in the fluidized beds, where you're taking air, I think. It is air, right? And you're sort of like blowing it through the particles, and that agitates the particles. Okay. And the issue here is that because the particles are large, they inevitably dissipate energy. And it turns out that is fundamentally different than elastic collisions, because it means in order to keep a temperature, you have to keep putting in energy. And the way the energy is put in is through some long wavelength thing, either something at the boundary or this gas. But again, it's a long wavelength perturbation that you're doing that's causing them to somehow have this energy. And the question is this driving plus collision the same as temperature would be in a thermal system? Okay? And how much is this driving plus collisions like real temperature? And there's a little bit of evidence that it's fundamentally different. Okay, and so that's what I'm going to show you, that here the point is that when you try to agitate the particles, you generate large-scale flows in geometries that would not demonstrate this phenomenon if the collisions were elastic. Okay, so I'm going to show you two things, one of which is a very simple model of a granular gas in a pipe by Zhu and Kadanoff, and then I'll show you one graph that I'm sure George Cody will show you soon. Okay, so here's the model that Zhu and Kadanoff looked at. And these vertical lines here, I used a bottle of whiteout on this, and I just like didn't have the guts to get rid of this line. I have no idea what that line is. It's in the center. These are the positions of the particles, okay? And what's happening here is that these are round particles, and they're in a pipe that's a little bit wider than the particles. So they can move in the other direction, but they can't pass each other, okay? And it's a simulation where this is a heated wall and that's a heated wall, and you know, the things get kicked whenever they make it to the wall, and then they collide with each other. And what you're supposed to notice is that you get this big clump that's sort of like going like this from side to side. So you're going like this at the end, and then you sort of end up with this clump. And
inelastic.
Yes. And thank you for that, because that was sort of the point, was that they were looking at the competition, well, not the competition, but the combination of the coefficient of restitution, which is the measure of the inelasticity, and the size of the system. Okay, and so what this is as a function of the coefficient of restitution goes up this way. So this is elastic, this is more inelastic, and there's some theory that I'm not going to go into about why you would want to plot this, but okay. And then on the y-axis is a measure of the velocity, well, it's nearest neighbor particles, and it's sort of the product of velocities versus the differences. And again, if you had completely elastic particles, then the velocity directions are uncorrelated, and this thing is zero. Okay? But as the things get more inelastic, then you get this clump, and you see this correlated velocity coming up. So that's point one. As it becomes inelastic, this correlation enters. And thing two is, as you increase the size of the system, the effect gets more and more important. This idea that, you know, you can't really drive it in a way where the particle velocities are really randomized. So to summarize that, the cooperativity gets more important as the elasticity increases and as the system size increases. And this has implications for theories of granular hydrodynamics, which is what you want to do. You want to coarse grain this thing. And the point is that there's these extra correlations that aren't there in a fluid. And so you have to do something to try to understand them. And I have nothing to say. This is an open question. But one thing I wanted to show you was a graph that George Cody's... are you going to show this? Yes. Okay. So I don't have to go in too much, but... So this is an experiment on... monodispersed glass spheres. And here's a granular temperature as a function of sphere diameter. Now, the trick here is that there's a general trend that the granular temperature is supposed to go up as the diameter goes up. So you would have expected, like, this curve to just go up. But what happens, you see, is that there's two regimes. Here it's going up, there it's going up, but there's a big break in the curve. And this break is associated with whether in this fluidized bed there are bubbles. Okay. And so the question is, why is there this bubbling transition? And again, I'm probably going to mangle what you're going to say, but my understanding of the paper was that this has to do with coupling of the local motions to large-scale shears in the system, that you have to couple these things together, and that's why you get this transition. And again, this is something that is inherent to granular materials that is not true just for fluids. Okay. So that's all I wanted to say about the gas. Now on to the liquid.
What would they help fix if you were keeping the flow from just increasing the size of the particles?
That is my understanding, but why don't you answer, because this is your paper. Well, he's just asking in the experiment. The particles are, size has changed, and he's saying, what's health fix? Okay, but I mean, this is one where I'm definitely going to defer to you. Yeah. Okay. You're good. And he's not complaining, so I guess I didn't do too badly on it. Okay. All right, so now I want to talk about sand as a liquid. And first of all, again, and just to follow up on this hydrodynamic business, saying that, first of all, there's this question of what the equations are. There seem to be more variables that come in. But then also the boundary conditions are not known. And I'll just show you a little evidence for that. And then I just wanted to say one or two words about the analog of the glass transition, which, again, Sid showed and also Sir Sam Edwards showed yesterday. And I just want to make a couple comments, because to me, how analogous these things are is a really interesting question, and I think really something to focus on. So the experiments I'm going to show you were done in Sid Nagel's lab, and they're experiments where you have a container, and it's shaken up and down, and this is the typical sizes, and then again, it's shaken and stopped, and shaken and stopped, and shaken and stopped, and then they measure various things, but, you know, I'll show you what they measure in a second. Okay, so the first thing, this is relevant to this boundary condition issue, is that there's convection. Now, in this conference, there's going to be not that much, except in the posters, I think there's some granular convection, but in the talks, there's not that much. So I don't want to say that much about it. But the thing you're supposed to notice here is, okay, this is an NMR image, where they tag the particles in these stripes, then they shake it, and then the stripes move because the particles move. And what you're supposed to notice is that the flow at the boundary is down. Okay, and this is different than fluids where you would have a no-slip boundary condition. Okay, where here there's definitely slip at the boundary. The velocity at the boundary is the maximum of anywhere in the system. And people think they understand this, or I think I understand it, and it's not like I worked on it, but people tell me things and it makes sense where they say, well, look, what happened is that the particles, you know, are there's friction on the walls, they're very rough walls, and when you go up, they're dragged down this way, and when it falls down, they're dragged up that way. But on the way up, the system is more dense than on the way down, and so the friction is more effective on the way up, so on the net, you have motion down at the walls. But this says that the boundary condition is density dependent, because that's how you got the motion in the first place. So it's obviously a more complicated boundary condition than in a regular fluid, which is just no slip independent of the density. So now this you've seen before, twice. This is, and also I guess Ed Novak is giving a talk, and he will show it again. And again, the point is that they've done this experiment, and as a function of the intensity of the shakes, you find the density has this irreversible behavior. And then, you know, you hit this point, and then here it doesn't matter what the history is, and here it does. And it's very analogous to a transition in spin glass. Yeah, Jim. We'll ask it out loud.
How was the irreversible one paired?
They fluff it with air. So there's like a thing at the bottom, and it goes... wait, Sid? Good, okay. and so it's... Okay, but is that correct? Okay, yeah, so... Okay, there you are. Okay, and so first of all, there's this... So did that answer the question?
Yes.
Good, okay. Okay, so first of all, there's this irreversibility, and you know, and there's a point that looks like a glass transition. But now I want to, and then also there's this slow relaxation, which I'm sure Ed will talk about, and then also there's some work on theoretical work on that. Well, and the slow relaxations together. But now I wanted to sort of talk a little bit more. Well, but let me just wait, Tom. Right. But let me say this about that, as Richard Nixon used to say. I mean, it's a very suggestive plot, I mean, in the sense. And so it leads to the question of, well, how much the same is it? I mean, so I just wanted to bring up one other experiment where I was going to talk about similarities and differences. So, you know, but it's there, and you're right. We don't know it's the same, but that's why it's a question as opposed to, we address the problem but don't solve it, as Dan Kivelton says. Okay. But that's the point. You're absolutely right. And that was the point I was hoping to make. Okay, so I just want to mention another experiment by a Hungarian group. And what they did here is here it is. They had a rod, and they stuck it in a cylinder, and then they measured the force you needed to get the rod to pull out of the medium. Okay, and this is, in my mind, roughly like a viscosity, right? You know, because you got a pull on it. Okay, but they looked at the thing as a function of density, and they didn't say exactly how they prepared it. So the question of this glass transition is unknown. So I'm not claiming that we understand this or that it's relevant even, but I'm saying it's suggestive. So what they did though is they would shake this thing and they measure the density, which we don't, you know, and then they would see how much force they needed to pull this thing out as a function of the density, okay? And this is what they found, that there was some sort of exponential increase. Now, let me say a couple things. First of all, if it really is exponential like this, then you'd say, well, gee, we were hoping it would be the Vogel-Fulcher law, right? We were hoping this thing would be faster than exponential, and it's not. Yes? No. They go... Yeah, I'm good at sound effects today, but all right. Yeah, all right. And then they measure density, but it's not shaking anymore. But that was how they got the density to change. So they did, and then, okay. This is all clear, right? Okay. I do not remember. I'm sorry. Yeah. No. They shake it with the rod in there. Well, that's what I don't know, okay? I mean, you know, the point is that, you know, if it's fluffy... It's standard friction. Wait, what was the question? I was going to do a lecture demonstration. What? What was the question? They claim not. And the other thing, their argument against it is they actually only pull a little weight. Okay, but you know, here it is. I can shove this thing down. Nothing's moving. I can pull it up. No big deal. Okay, and the claim is you do this, and then you, if you get the density high enough, it gets harder and harder to pull it out. Okay, then, yeah. Well, okay. And it, okay, well, no. Absolutely. Well, and that was, I mean, I did this to be, well, I'm doing a great job. I'm getting questions. Okay, no, the point, I did this to be provocative, okay, of how much is this the same? And the other thing is, if you did this with a, you know, you pulled out something out of a, you know, out of a supercooled liquid, you'd have to keep pulling. And if you do it here, like, once you get it to go, boom, it comes out. So, you know, I don't know how much the same this is. I just thought it was something that might interest people. Yeah.
It belongs more to the solid part rather than the liquid part. Because it's really what you're looking at is once it's all settled and then you have some kind of, you know, force network built in there and then you're pulling it and basically you want to determine how fast part you need to pull it.
That's true. Fine. You heard the comment. The comment was that really you're looking at the solid properties. And that's true, but... You're measuring something about the stress tensor. But on the other hand, the experiment that I showed you with the two curves, let me show you. This experiment is done the same way. You take the taps, and at the moment they take this data, nothing is moving. Okay, so it's to the extent that, you know, curve one is a glass transition, curve two is also. Okay, so you know, but is it the same? I have no idea. I'm trying to get you thinking, and I'm doing a great job. Okay, so again, why would it be different? All right, well, why would it be the same as this idea of the frustration and the jamming and the geometric constraints? But again, the noise is quite different. And not only that, but when you're taking the data in the sand, nothing's moving. Okay, you prepared it by, you know, shaking it. But, you know, at the moment when all of those data were taken, nothing is moving in the granular material. Whereas in glass, it's always subject to thermal noise. What? I have no idea. Well, I mean, something would happen. The rod would come out eventually. That I know. But I do not know. Okay? The question was, what if they did the data while they were shaking? Answer is, I don't know. Okay. And so then, you know, and again, this question of the no cohesive forces. And does it matter? We don't know. I don't know. Okay, so now I want to say a few words about sand as a solid. And here, the work that I just want to mention has to do with stress propagation. Two different questions. One is the large-scale structures, which Joachim Wittmer is going to talk about. And then the small-scale fluctuations, which is actually the work that I've been doing, and Dan Muth has a poster, and you can always ask me if you want to hear about what we've done. And here it turns out that very crucial that those forces are not cohesive, or I believe this. Actually, Sid disagrees, so we can have a discussion on that. But one thing that I think is crucial here that is a theme is the role of the boundaries, that I think that it could be that if we understand the role of the boundaries in this problem, it might help us more generally, because that's a recurring theme. And Sir Sam Edwards showed this yesterday, but I will show it again. The reason why this is complex is because in addition to being random, which is already a problem, because of friction, there's many ways to balance the forces and torques. And so therefore, you don't know the relations, you know, you don't know actually what the forces are between two particles if you know where they are, because the friction force could be anything in a certain range. And so you have to do something to be able to figure out what the forces actually are. So the issues that both of those things are is can be summed up here, which is this question of, well, what's happening under this foot when you're standing on the sand? Okay. So let me, I'll talk about just this question of the large scale first. And again, Sir Sam Edwards showed this. The point is that it's clear that there are some unusual load-bearing properties in granular materials, and one example is the famous stress dip, where you take a pile and the stress looks like this, There's some question about, you know, actual experimental details, but clearly it's quite possible to get a dip and dips have been seen by many groups. Here are some data which I stole from Claudin's and Felt thesis, and these are the famous Novosad data. And again, here's the picture. This is shear. This is the dip that you're supposed to look at. Sorry. And you see here's this dip at the center. Okay. So the question is, well, why would that happen? That there'd be a minimum in the forest. And really the key idea for the picture that of Dr. Whitmer's talk, I think, was due to this paper that was in this paper of Edwards and Winfield, where the idea was that somehow you sort of form these bridges, okay? And so the stress was sort of propagating down along these angles, and if you have this sort of simple cartoon, you find the pressure distribution actually looks like that. So the picture is that, you know, load is supported in a very bizarre kind of way. There's some very beautiful work, which you'll hear some of, and where basically Whitmer, Case, Claudin, and then Bouchot also, but this is the long paper, so I refer to that. And they put it in this context of, you know, differential equations to describe, you know, load-bearing capacity and constitutive equations. And obviously, it has to be determined by history, because what else could determine it? But then they had a particular proposal for how to close these equations. One of the key features is that the stress propagates down on these light cones. Okay, so you bridge at the top and stresses sort of go down. And this yields a stress dip, and you'll hear a lot more about that. Well, let me defer that, because you're going to explain that in a lot of detail. But the point is that it is quite... The one point I want you to take away... I mean, I'm running out of time. The one point I want to take you away is that in this model, you push on the top and the stress goes down. And that's quite different from elasticity theory, where there you have some differential equations and some boundary conditions and then you solve. Okay, so either this theory is right, in which case it's a new state of matter, right? You know, I mean, or the theory is wrong, in which case then we have a lot to understand. Okay, but this idea that you push at the top and the stresses go down happens to be the way the progress in the last few years has all been made. Okay, our model is the same way. You push at the top and the stresses go down. But I don't know if that's correct. If it is correct, then it's very interesting. Okay. So I summed up into two things. It's like, is the whole theory correct? Which is one question. But even if it is has some problems in detail, there's also this idea of, you know, is that the right way of thinking about it, where stresses only go down? And if so, it's only because the material is non-cohesive. I'll say one or two things about the stress fluctuation. Again, there's a bunch of experiments at Chicago in Sid Nagel's group, and Dan Muth is going to have a poster. He's been working with Heinrich Jaeger and Sid. And where first there are these pictures, one of which Sid showed, but then also there's some quantitative data that they got the following way. And actually, the experiment is more sophisticated than this, but this is as good as I could draw. Okay, big weight on top, and you have all the particles, and then you have a piece of carbon paper here and a piece of white paper under the carbon paper, and then what they do is they measure the smudges, and from that you get a measure of how big the forces are. And so I'll, again, just show you really quickly this famous, I guess it's famous now, exponential. Okay, so this is Dan's data. Again, he has a poster, so you can see where, you know, so this is what you're supposed to see, okay, that the force distribution over 2 decades, say, 2.5, is exponential. And this is what we call a pretty long tail. So we made a model of that, but I have to stop, so I won't tell you about the model. But let me just say, oh, sorry, that's not the summary I wanted. That the model does reproduce this exponential tail and has some other good features. And since I don't have time to go into the details, I'll just say it's like unbelievably wonderful how well this model works. And But the point is, and this has in common with Whitmer et al., is that forces only propagate downwards. Now, it happens that I have to admit to you that that was sort of a historical accident, because it turns out that if forces only propagate one way, the model is much easier to solve, so that's what we did. But is this true? And the fact that, again, the Whitmer, Cates, Claudin, Bouchot has a similar property, I think is really a fundamental question about granular materials. Is this the right way to be thinking about them? And so that's why I said bugger feature. If it's a feature, then it means it's really different than solids with cohesion. If it's a bug, well then, we have a lot of work to do. Okay. And so this sums up, so one way of putting this question is, so you have this thing and you define the forces at the top. So suppose you change something at the bottom. If these models are correct, that implies that the pile must rearrange. Because, again, everything is determined by the top and the packing, and so, you know, if you do something at the bottom, something else must change. And so that really, if these models are correct, is telling you something very fundamental about granular materials. Okay, so let me summarize. So these were the points I was hoping to make. I cheated a little. I just said fluid here. The points when sand is fluidized is this question of the correlated velocities due to inelasticity that's fundamentally different than regular hydrodynamics. And then the other point is that we don't know the boundary conditions. The second point is this jamming transition, and the question, the however many thousand dollar question, is how much like a glass transition is it? And so I brought up, you know, this question of is there a viscosity, and if so, is this pooling experiment the right measure? And then finally is a solid that the work that's been done over the last few years on understanding the stresses means the way these models are would actually imply that sand is, you know, very different from elastic solids. And I think that's where I'd like to stop. Thanks. Yeah.
The large one is compared to the size of
yeah.
the temple, and the small one is compared to the size of the grain.
Yeah.
Don't you need a very deep and middle footprint to do the weight to the size of the small grain or the texture?
Okay. The question is there's the microscopic or, you know, size of the grain. There's the size of the system, and is there a length scale that's in between? And I will answer just in the context of our force chain theory, where there is a scale of the force chains, but it's a factor different than the size of the grains. It is not a fundamentally new length scale. Okay? And I think that there are things that are left out of our model, and many things could be wrong with it, and there could be a different length scale, but that's really the issue. Is the mesoscopic scale 5, or is the mesoscopic scale a new scale? Okay, if our model is correct, then it's fine. Okay. Well, or 3 or whatever. It's some number of times the grain size. It's not a fundamentally new length scale. Do I think there's a difference? It's a factor of 5. Yeah. I just don't know the answer. I mean, I'm only answering in the context of our model where it doesn't scale differently. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh. Well, obvious. I mean, yes. I mean, the point is that if we understood this intermediate scale, could we go from discrete to continuum? Yes. I just don't know how. So that's why the talk was the way it was, because there are all sorts of things I don't know, and that's one. Yeah.
The issues in terms of the solid properties is really essentially properties of sand on the surface of the earth, because once you take out the gravity,
yeah.
You basically lose all these properties. You know, then, you know, if you think of sand as something by itself and not in the presence of gravity, the question is to be quite different. And then, you know, you have to think about it in terms of, well, then the boundary for it to be done is not in the environment. So is that, do you want to narrow the point of view to really focus on that structure, or do you want to think of sand as, you know, in a more general sense, you also want to understand that what happens when, you know, body forces are unimportant and it's really the boundary forces that play a role in what happens then?
Okay, I'll just repeat the question for the web. Okay, the question for the web was, we really had gravity in here, and if gravity was not there, then the boundary forces would determine everything. Okay, and do we want to specialize? Well, I mean, I obviously specialize. My theory is, you know, it's pushed and whatever, and you could either apply stress or you could put it in gravity, makes no difference. But the general question, and I think this is really relevant to the fluidized bed, the thing's sort of floating and you're in this gaseous phase. And, you know, if we understood the gaseous phase, then, you know, you have this picture of you have the particles in space or whatever and there's no gravity. Fine. But, right. Okay, but I'm just sort of saying that these other two phases, I believe, are, you know, it's worthwhile thinking about gravity. It's round. So, I mean, yeah, I guess it's true that I think in the gas phase, then, you know, it's very easy to imagine not thinking about gravity, but in the solid, yeah, I'd say, yeah, I like thinking about gravity. It's something I feel good about. But that doesn't mean that there aren't interesting questions. It's just my view. Okay. Oh, there's one more. Anita? Yeah. Absolutely. Right. Okay. Okay, let me say this about that. Okay, the question was, our model doesn't really have arching in it, okay? And that's a weakness, okay? Our philosophy is... Well, and now I get to go on a little bit about my model or our model. But the point is that there's this sort of large-scale structures of how the stress is born. Okay, and there, you know, our model has very little to say. And our picture is that we're looking for fluctuations about the local mean. And you can sort of put arching in our model in a backhanded kind of way by fiddling with the probability distribution. And we did this because we did know that we had left it out. And what happens is that we focused on the aspects that were independent of the distribution function. So you can change it to functions that really have what you know, I could show it to you and it would look like it was arching. Okay. But, you know, the exponential tail still holds. And that's why we really focused on the exponential tail, because the rest of the curve you can get to do anything. Okay. Yeah. Right. Well, one thing we did is that one way of thinking about arching is that you have things that that are fewer than the mean number of neighbors. So what you can do is you can just set a bunch of Q's to zero and see what happens to the distribution. But the other thing I can tell you is that in the simulations, you know, now at this point there are quite a few simulations that have been done. I mean, there's the Rajai et al. And there's a group at Duke. Rick Cleland has some simulations. They are, I mean, you know, they have, like, you know, in the computer pretty realistic particles. The Rajai are contact dynamics, and the Cleland are molecular dynamics. Okay. Yeah, and so there they see really quite an impressive exponential tail. I mean, because to tell you the truth, the model, which I haven't told you, was wonderful, but it's a cartoon, and, you know, and again, if it had been wrong, you know, life would have gone on. I mean, because there are many places that could have been off, and one is just this, but the fact is it seems to capture something. How much is the issue? Not the exponential tail. It affects everything else, but not the fact that the tail is exponential is robust.